Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, the never predictable Rick Hess.
Good to be here.
How are you today, Rick?
Oh, pretty well, pretty well.
Good, good, good. Well, let's get right into it today, shall we? We're going to start with a game of Pardon the Gadfly, where we debate three of the burning issues of the week. Then we'll have an interview, and finally a shot of News of the Weird. I'm feeling unforgivable today, Rick, so I hope you brought your game.
Unforgivable.
That's right.
Not unforgiven, baby, not unforgiving. I like that. I like the verb play. All right, topic number one. The Associated Press reported this week that 1,700 schools across the country have been ordered into radical restructuring, subject to mass firings, closures, state takeover, and all kinds of other plagues. Mike, is there reason to believe that these failing schools are finally going to face an extreme makeover?
Well, Rick, I wish that they were. I mean, these schools have been failing for 6 years at least. Now, think about that. That means if you're a sixth grader, your school has been failing since you were in first grade, okay? And yet, what do we see out there when school districts are supposed to do something dramatic, but all they do is they just, you know, make a little change to the curriculum, or they bring in a coach, or maybe they remove the principal. They're not doing the radical overhauls that No Child Left Behind is all about. And they're doing this because there's one loophole in the law that allows school districts to basically come up with any kind of change and call it restructuring. And I'm mad about it. I don't think it's right. I think that is unforgivable.
You're clearly, there
but
you
I
go,
am
baby.
Unforgiving on
I,
this point.
I like it. Now, it sounds to me like more of your right-wing, wild-eyed, unsophisticated bomb-throwing. Mike, we know a lot about capacity building, about coaching them up, about pedagogical and curricular reform. Isn't what you're talking about really nothing more than a simple-minded, let's stomp on them on heavy combat boots, hate some teachers
absolutely.
Kind of
you
solution?
Know, in fact, you know what I would say? This is like your house is on fire and you're out front mowing the lawn. This is what this is like.
And I you're mean, saying the schools, educators are the folks out mowing the lawn while the house is on fire?
I think they're both on fire and they're mowing
the lawn. And they're mowing their lawns and they're using gas mowers. So what does that say about what you think
exactly.
of their judgment?
Exactly.
We got folks using gas mowers outside a burning house. Don't they know they could get scalded and burn?
Exactly.
I don't understand. Why the hell would they do this?
But you know what? Seriously. All right. These schools are really in bad shape. There's now 1,700 of these schools around the country. The numbers are growing big time. It's up 44% from last year. In just a matter of years, I'm sure we're going to hit 5,000, 10,000 of these schools. The big question for No Child Left Behind and for the whole credibility of the law is anything going to happen to these schools at the end of the day?
Well, so this was actually...
All right. That's it. It's over.
It's over, baby.
It's over.
It's over.
We, for you listeners, we are trying a new buzzer today. And
It's over buzzer.
It's over buzzer.
Okay.
Very nice. Liam sounded a little bit angry today.
He's an angry young man.
He is an angry young man.
And okay. He's weird to boot.
Okay. Well, speaking of angry, weird young men, topic number two. This has to do with David Brooks. You know, very nice columnist from the New York Times. Although some people call him maybe angry and young. Okay, are policymakers missing the boat? This weekend, David Brooks argued in his New York Times column that rather than just offer structural remedies like charter schools, education policymakers should, and I quote, enter the murky world of psychology and human nature and talk, quote, about core psychological traits like delayed gratification skills when trying to spur social change. Rick, has David Brooks got swam up into this Sigmund Freud hero worship?
You know, Mike, I mean, what's funny is part of what Brooks talked about was this psychology literature that was, you know, developed back in the 50s and 60s. And it was based on stuff like if you offered kids a marshmallow today and they ate it, this was a bad thing. Because if you offered them a marshmallow today but said, tell you what, don't eat any marshmallows today, I'll give you two tomorrow, this was a good thing. So David Brooks is basically worried that kids aren't eating enough marshmallows tomorrow. First off, in a country filled with fat kids, I'm not sure that this is a pressing concern. But, you know, that's just nitpicking. No, the bottom line here is anytime I hear conservative reformers start talking about, quote, core psychological traits being developed by government action, I'm worrying. I'm wondering where the hell are these guys going and who the heck is it that's standing up and saying there's limits to what you can do, there's limits to the perfectibility of human beings, and that we've got to, you know, encourage sensible schools to form rather than push national agendas of right thinking or, you know, good psychological profiling.
Right, right, right. And furthermore, you know, the structural reforms that we're pushing for, like charter schools, let's say, make some of this a lot more likely, right? I mean, some of the best schools in the country are charter schools, and these schools can get at some of these core psychological issues because they work with the kids on a day-to-day basis. You know, they have teachers who are very committed to their success. They work with them for longer times. They can teach them these kinds of values like delaying gratification. I mean, you can't do that from Washington or from Sacramento, but you can make it more likely that good charter schools are going to come into being.
And right? In fact, I mean, it's tough to do in traditional public schools when you're juggling a bunch of responsibilities, when you've got teachers who have to negotiate a whole bunch of input regulations and requirements. It gets real difficult to worry about cultivating and focusing on student discipline and student drive. You know, the notion that we can simply, by promoting some kind of right psychological agenda, make otherwise dysfunctional public schools start to work is probably a pipe dream.
All right. But is it fair that some reformers
No more.
The no more guy.
No more. Like I said, I kind of missed the buzzer, you know?
I like the no more thing.
All right, Rick. I know there's no more, but one quick question, Rick. So had you been offered the marshmallow, would you have taken it or would you have waited for the second marshmallow?
Well, you know, the thing is, and this is what I think Brooks is missing, is you're poking my marshmallowness, right? No, the thing is,
that's
if
really,
you know.
No more.
If a guy's offering you two marshmallows, you know he's packing at least two marshmallows.
That's right.
So, I don't, you know, this whole notion that kids are going to sit around and politely say, please give it to me. I mean, a smart kid is going to say, look, dude, I'm going to kick your ass if you don't give me both marshmallows now. And you go into him forcefully. He's got a backpack on. He's got a briefcase. You take the whole damn bag resell.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
A little insight into Rick's child psychology.
I'm saying you teach entrepreneurial behavior. Okay. All right. Final topic, Mike. Gays and lesbians. More specifically, perhaps, whether textbooks should be required to note the contributions of gays and lesbians to society, as a new California law is mandating. Mike, should students be required to know that Alexander the Great was attracted to guys and not gals?
All right, Rick. Well, here's the point. Now, first of all, of course, gays and lesbians should not be excluded from history. I mean, there's a lot of gays and lesbians that made important contributions to history, right? But it's not clear to me why it's important for students to know the fact that they were gay or lesbian or straight, that their sexual orientation really matters. I mean, you know, if you're doing a recent history, for example, you know, does it matter what Janet Reno's sexuality is, you know, one way or the other? I mean, how is that relevant? What your kids really should know is, well, she was the attorney general and here's what she did in terms of policy, right? I mean, I'm trying to imagine a case where it would be relevant to know these sorts of things about these people. And I just can't come up with any answer.
Mike, that's because you're a square white guy. I mean, you might say the same thing about Martin Luther King or Jackie Robinson. I mean, you could say, well,
no,
it doesn't matter.
Wait, are you insinuating that they were gay?
No, they were black. No. I'm saying, look, you could treat everybody as colorless, you know, non-sexual, vague, gelatinous beings. But doesn't this give us insight into the world that they live in?
Rick. Martin Luther King Jr., you know, was the leader of the civil rights movement, which was all about giving African-American people rights. And Jackie Robinson integrated baseball. Their race mattered a lot, right? But give me an example of where somebody's sexual, identification would matter.
Well, I'm sure there are some. But I gotta sympathize with you. I mean, and in fact, what I'm wondering about too is, does the law mandate that you have to have gays and lesbians of different ethnicities and religious backgrounds represented? Because if all your gays, say, are Christian whites, right, and you don't have any Hasidic Jew gays, and you're a young Hasidic Jew child, then are you not being properly exposed to, you know, role models who you might embrace?
Right. All right. And this is gonna
you're
be
done.
Even...
You're done. We're done with this.
Yeah. You know, I think we got to bring back the buzzer. You know, I
kind of like this. It feels very humane.
All right. Very well, it is humane, I guess. But it just doesn't really make me want to stop talking is the problem.
Mike, few things do.
Okay, very good. All right. Well, thankfully, that is it for Pardon the Gadfly this week. Now we turn to our interview, which is with Dave Saba, who is president of the American Board for Certification of Teacher Excellence, otherwise known as ABCTE. And as you know, this group is creating an alternate route for new teachers, as well as a master teacher credential. They released a new study today looking at the relationship between their certification exam and the value teachers add to student achievement. So let's take a listen. Dave, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Thanks for having me.
So Dave, first of all, in 30 seconds or less, tell our listeners, what's the big takeaway from the study that you released today?
ABCTE is on track. In order to be on track, you have to validate your exams, and that's what this study did. We set out to validate our exams, and experts say that in order to validate them, you have to show that people who pass your exams can perform at a higher level than those who fail. We had veteran teachers take the exams. Those with higher learning gains passed, and those that didn't pass had lower learning gains.
So when you say learning gains, you're talking about their students then?
Their students, yes. We wanted to look at it from a value-add position and see that the value-add that the teachers who passed was certainly higher than those that failed.
Okay, good. Now, you know, is this something that every test would show, or is this something that's special about ABCTE?
This is something unique to us, but when I started looking at certifications, this is kind of the first thing that I thought would be a great way to validate an exam was to look at how teachers perform in the classroom through value-add. So this is the first of its kind study like this.
Okay, very good. Now, some critics have argued that the sample size, the number of teachers that took this test, was really very small, and so you can't draw too many conclusions or make too much out of it. What do you say to those folks?
I would say that validation has to occur in steps, and the first step is to get a comfort level with the exams that you have, and that's what we've done here. The next step is a 5-year longitudinal study of our teachers, of teachers who go through our program once they get out in the field and look at the value add that they're bringing to the classroom. So this is the first step, and it is statistically significant. We did that through a two-tailed t-test that the expert says will definitely show that it is statistically relevant.
Okay. You know, terms like t-test go right over my head, Dave. But
Especially they go over my head, too, and that's why we bring in a Herb Wahlberg and Jay Green to help us with that.
That was very impressive. Good. Now, you know, a lot of reformers, myself included, see a lot of promise in the American Board and the idea of bringing in thousands, maybe someday, of qualified teachers through alternate routes. But unfortunately, we've only seen a couple of states adopt it. So what are you doing to change that?
Right now, what those states need to see is that we're willing to work with them, that we have data on the program, and that we have a true ability to bring candidates in. So we've been addressing all of those needs. I've visited 15 state capitals over the last 5 months, spoken with the education leaders there, and that's what they're telling me, and that's what we're starting to deliver. We now have 2,000 candidates working on the program, which means we should have 1,000 teachers ready for the fall, even in just the 5 states that we have. So we're bringing that, the data, this is the first of the data that we're bringing out there. We're doing a principal survey that'll be complete this summer. All of that will help show them that this is a worthwhile program. And then finally, we're working with them to develop a first-year mentoring and induction program that they're comfortable with that really will make sure that these teachers are effective.
Okay. All right, good. But, Dave, I mean, isn't this really just about politics to a large degree? I mean, all of that you talk about, the substance, the data should help, but aren't the unions just out there to kill you because they're worried you're going to bring in lots of new teachers into the profession and, you know, and instead of coming through all the barriers that they've put in place?
I don't know about the politics per se, but it is a political issue as to what teachers should be brought in. And what we're trying to do is make sure that we can bring that out of the equation, take politics out by bringing in data and bringing in a mentoring program that can really make sure that these are going to be great teachers.
Okay.
It boils right down to it. The teacher crisis is coming. There is a huge shortage, and we're helping alleviate that.
Okay. Well, all right, one last question on politics. Also this week, we learned that the National Board, your rival, so to speak, has been burying a study that showed that their teachers actually are not outperforming other teachers in the classroom, the teachers that get National Board certification. I mean, what's your take on this? Is this going to help you, do you think?
Right now, we're operating mainly on the entry-level teacher, but we are introducing our master teacher program, which will be looking at student learning gains as a way of ensuring that somebody can qualify for a master teacher, and they also have to have the subject matter knowledge. So I'm not sure if that's going to help or hurt or bring more focus on that program, but we are certainly working with as many groups as possible to make sure that there are enough great programs that we retain more teachers in the classroom that are great.
Okay, Dave. Boy, we just can't get you to go after the unions or the National Board or anyone, can we?
No, we got to make sure that we're working with everybody so that we can help solve this problem together.
Okay. Well, you know what? That might be a successful strategy for the American Board. Gladly, here at the Education Gadfly Show, we don't have to be quite so politic. All right, Dave. Thanks again for joining us, and I hope you come back.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Take care, buddy.
So, Rick, Dave was really pulling his punches, eh?
Man, this is the reason why folks who are actually trying to run organizations are probably the least insightful and least interesting to listen to about policy developments, because they can't say anything. They're so busy trying to maintain alliances and, you know, avoid offending anybody in power that all they give you is pablum.
Right. No offense, Dave, our very nice guest who agreed to join us.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's more of a general point than anything else.
Okay. But is the message this week, Rick, that kind of thumbs up on the American board and thumbs down on the national board? Is it that simple?
No, it's probably not that simple. I mean, American board data, we haven't seen in its entirety yet. All we've seen is a release. It's a small sample, but it looks, you know, reasonably positive, and it's a positive indicator. The national board, there's a couple of studies out, especially Dan Goldhaber's work, and folks can make of it what they will. And the fact that one study has, you know, that they've been sitting on, it's hard to know exactly what to make of it until we see it and kind of think about the findings.
Okay, good. Well, it's time for everyone's favorite now, Education News of the Weird, with our very special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what is weird this week?
Well, Mike, we're headed to the City of Angels, where last weekend over 400 LA teachers attended a conference about how to integrate rap into their daily lessons. Teacher Erica Carducci told a reporter that she uses Eminem lyrics to teach Robert Frost, because her students are, quote, so turned off to the traditional notion of how they're supposed to be learning, unquote. Good idea, terrible execution. For instance, the conference never addressed whether teachers should base their lesson plans around East Coast rappers or West Coast rappers.
Whoa.
Yeah, such an oversight is inexcusable, especially when there is an abundance of literature, including the Fordham Foundation report, Rapper's Delight, Hip Hop Choice, and School Curricula, available on this topic. The last thing we need in the nation's K-12 schools is another rap war sparked by clueless geometry teachers. Rick, why are they tripping?
You know, this is one of those imponderables. Now, if you'd been at AERA with Mike and me, though, Liam, you would have had the chance to go to the panels which actually focused on hip-hop pedagogies. And if you had been there, you would have understood that there is a wealth of data-driven, important research. Well, not really. I have no idea what they're doing. Who the heck is funding this stuff? Might be the bigger question.
See, Rick, once again, that is because you are nothing but a square white guy.
This is true. Is this our tax dollars funding the conference on hip-hop pedagogies?
One has to wonder. But yo, 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 that's all the time we have for this week. So thank you for joining us. Don't forget to read the original Education Gadfly at www.edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
I'm Mike Petrilli. Thank you, Liam, for your excellent job with News of the Weird and for that buzzer alternative. We're all from the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, at least some of us, signing off.